This is the Oslo Governance Centre's Preventing Violent Extremism podcast series. I'm Annelise McAuliffe. Today we're discussing the role of uncivil society. What is uncivil society and how does it manifest? How do uncivil parts of civil society grow and expand from the margins of associational life? And what linkages can be made between some illiberal and uncivil groups and radicalization and violent extremism? My guests today are Vedi Hadiz, the Director and Professor of Asian Studies at the Asia Institute and an Assistant Deputy Vice Chancellor International at the University of Melbourne.
A lot of the assumptions about the relationship between democracy and civil society, about civil society and liberalism, needs to be questioned at the core and to look at the way things have historically and empirically panned out in various cases across Asia just over the last 20 or 30 years.
Mario Gomez is the Executive Director at the International Center for Ethnic Studies, an independent think tank in Sri Lanka. He's worked in academia, human rights, and peace building.
I think one of the functions of civil society has been to be a critique of governance and of the state. But oppressive states have realized the value of civil society in that respect, and therefore unleashed their own illiberal civil society movements in a way. As a way of boosting their politics and their power.
Thinsa Shinlayi is a pro-democracy and anti-coup campaigner from Myanmar. For the last decade, she's been involved with civil society groups in Myanmar, focusing on inclusion and human rights.
Myanmar has no civil society for more than three decades under the military junta, and they don't really know what does it mean, democracy or human rights.
So, let's get started.
Professor Vedi Hadiz, people working across peace building and governance have become accustomed to the concept that civil society is important for both transitioning to democracy and strengthening governance, as well as for economic prosperity. So what has happened for some elements of civil society to become uncivil or illiberal? What has changed?
First of all, I think the conceptualization of civil society itself, it has been somewhat erroneous in that a lot of international organizations have actually followed a particular stream within academic thinking in relation to civil society, which you might call the sort of Tocquevillian kind of perspective, whereby, associational life almost inevitably has liberal consequences and that it serves as a pillar to democracy. But this is a very ahistorical way actually of looking at civil society. I mean, throughout history, we've seen associational life, not just in the Asian region, but also in Europe and America and Latin America, where uncivil society groups have developed together with associational life. I mean, the best example I can give you is the Nazi Party over in Germany. And you've got, in contemporary times, many sort of representatives of very illiberal sorts of politics sort of associating even in the West, related to the BNP, let's say, in Britain, the Front National in France, the D Party in the United States. So should you be really surprised when you see, organizations of illiberal thinking, sort of anti-democratic people popping up in places like Indonesia, where democratization occurred 20 or so years ago, or Sri Lanka, where there was recently a very long civil war, or Myanmar, where the process of democratization has been very top-down and very much orchestrated in the interests of the military. And I think in all of these cases in Asia, a lot of the so-called uncivil society groups have emerged out of the fringes of civil society, but have become mainstream because of tutelage from within powerful groups within the state or outside of the state, and therefore from the fringes of society, they become more mainstream in terms of their ideas, in terms of the norms that they propagate and so on, because they are useful for elements of the status quo in maintaining that status quo.
Great, thank you. And I think it is very important to point out that we're talking about Asia today because we're all sitting in the Asia region, not because it only is an issue happening in Asia. Now, Mario, in terms of Sri Lanka, can you tell us about what happened in terms of the co-option or the failure of civil society in terms of peace building in Sri Lanka?
Well, I just want to add a comment to what Wendy mentioned about how the state is, in a sense, co-opted civil society. I think one of the functions of civil society has been to be a critique of governance and of the state. But oppressive states have realized the value of civil society in that respect, and therefore unleashed their own illiberal civil society movements in a way, as a way of boosting their politics and their power. So that's what sort of happened in Sri Lanka. But beyond that, of course, Sri Lankan civil society groups have had to contend with fairly repressive measures over the years. A lot of it has also been ethnicized because during the conflict over a 26-year period, we found civil society groups that supported a peaceful negotiation with the armed movements. And then the state reacting to that by arguing that civil society was unpatriotic, was in a way also supporting terrorism by not supporting the state in their drive to sort of crush the militant movement. So we've had civil society really struggle around issues, mainly around civil and political rights, but also more recently on issues of religious freedom. And we've seen a huge growth in sort of hate speech, not only against ethnic minorities, women, and sort of LGBT groups, but also against civil society, you know, attacking peace activists, attacking human rights activists as being unpatriotic, and trying to demonize the sort of work they're doing. So at the moment, I think civil society in Sri Lanka is sort of challenged. And there is a fear that there might be a more stringent regulatory regime that might be introduced by the state in a way to try and control civil society.
That brings us very neatly to you, because you have been a very prominent civil society activist and human rights defender in Myanmar, and you have very much come under attack yourself personally, but also the groups that you've worked for. Now, how do you feel about the position of civil society that you've worked in Myanmar over the last 10 years or so? How much freedom was given to civil society to really take up the role that it is ideally supposed to take up in a democratic society?
So Myanmar has been under the military dictatorship for the past six decades, so only 10 years in between as a transition towards democracy. But when we look back our transitions, I just generally perceive this as such a fake transition period, because that damage has been done in the past 10 years. And now as a civil society, coming from different backgrounds, Myanmar has all the charity organizations were highly favored by the military government in the past, you know, 20 years, 30 years.
Betty, I want to move on to looking at sort of like how the mainstreaming of social and economic grievances happens through nationalist and religious politics. Mm. So in a country in Indonesia, for example, how does a nationalist and religious agenda get embedded into civil society? And how does that then perhaps transform into being in a liberal civil society movement?
Besides destroying the left, what the new order did was destroy any possibility for the development of social bases for liberal and or social democratic ideas through a very highly regulated and effective repressive authoritarian system, right? So Another thing that happened in the new order, though, was that, yes, you had rapid development that then came together with increasing social inequalities, right? And this has carried over into the democratic period. This tendency toward greater inequalities was not reversed with democratization, but was actually exacerbated. So now you have a situation where you have lots of, room for grievances against, social inequalities, lack of access to this and that, at the same time that people are becoming more educated and have higher aspirations and so on, but they don't have a frame of thinking to sort of articulate their grievances. Why? There is no left, there is no liberalism, there is no social democracy. What there is statist nationalism, and there is Islam. Okay, so that's all you've got, right? So therefore, the civil society groups that have emerged in Indonesia basically, articulate different variations of statist nationalist and or Islamist ideas, rather than liberal, social democratic kinds of ideas. And therefore, it is possible that, at the very outer fringes of this civil society that you can map in this way, there will be groups, right, that are extremely anti-democratic and illiberal, right, at the outer fringes of nationalism, hyper-nationalists, right, at the outer fringes of Islamism, right, radical Islamism, right?
Mario, exactly. Do you see parallels there with Sri Lanka?
Well, I think in Sri Lanka, it would be slightly different because I think, Sri Lanka is deeply divided along ethnic and religious lines. And I think civil society also reflects some of those divisions. So, for example, on issues pertaining to the ethnic conflict, on accountability for human rights violations during the last phase of the war, for example, there are serious divisions within civil society in terms of pursuing some of these issues. I think where liberal civil society has come together has been around issues of democracy, democratic governance, corruption, and so on. So I think perhaps slightly different from Indonesia, where perhaps the cooptation hasn't been as extensive as it has been in that country.
But we have our liberal civil society organizations too. I mean, a smattering of them. But I guess my point is that they can be vocal, they can be in the newspapers, and they can be on television from time to time, but they have no social base.
I think that's what's quite interesting. And even though that we acknowledge and know that they are small groups on the fringes of one extreme or another, how do they gain traction in Myanmar, in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia, or any other country that you're studying? How do they gain traction and make themselves into this outsized power that actually influences policy and serves in a kind of mushrooming way to radicalize youth and others?
No, I think in Sri Lanka, one of the problems in recent years has been, of course, radical movements supported tacitly by the state that have used the end of the war in 2009 to create a new other, which is, and the new other is the Muslims, of course, and of course, evangelical Christians. So we've had the emergence of Sinhala Buddhist radical groups, sometimes led by members of the Buddhist clergy and so on, which have received tacit support from the state in terms of both the offline violence they engage in, but also the online violence where they use social media and other spaces to engage in violence. So I think to us, that's really been one of the challenges.
Sensationally, do you see any parallels in what Mario and Vedi have spoken about in terms of recruitment and radicalization?
Basically, Myanmar is a war-torn country. So all these conflicts at the same time create another sort of militarizations, going strong. At the same time, the nationalism becoming more extreme, because all the ethnic groups inside the country, they feel they are underrepresented and they want to protect their own identity, but in a way that they are protecting in a more extreme manner at the same time. Myanmar has no civil society for more than three decades in under the military junta, and they don't really know what does it mean democracy or human rights. And the first thing we do is to raise awareness about diversity. For example, we don't really know what does it mean diversity, or we have no idea how to translate even to the word hate speech. We were not informed about all these things. And then when that hate speeches happened online, they were all unchecked, and that escalate all the tension across the whole country.
Mario, I want to ask you about the role of donors, because when particularly Western donors come into a country and they kind of back certain civil society groups, does that ever set up or enhance this kind of fracture in a society whereby it gives more impetus to push against these organizations that are perhaps funded by big international donors? Does it empower the backlash?
Governments have constantly attacked civil society because they are recipients of foreign funding. And so that has been used as a stick to kind of brand human rights groups, peace groups, as advancing an agenda that emanates from the West. So that's been one of the attack lines of government constantly. But I think, donors are also not a homogeneous group. And obviously those donors who are a little more consultative, who are willing to engage with civil society and also invest perhaps, even if the sums are not large, but invest in sort of funding that extends over a larger period of time, I think perhaps have a sort of greater impact.
Reddy, any final thoughts from you?
I think that the issue of uncivil society is one that needs to be faced frontally across the region, whether we're domestic actors fighting for democracy in our own countries, or we're sympathetic donor organizations or foreigners. I think that a lot of the assumptions about the relationship between democracy and civil society, about civil society and liberalism, needs to be questioned at the core, and to look at the way things have historically and empirically panned out in various cases across Asia just over the last 20 or 30 years. I think there has to be an element of modesty as well about what foreign aid and so on, while necessary, can actually achieve, because it is the domestic political constellation of social forces that is going to determine whether a country actually develops in a more liberal and or more democratic way. In 98, 99, all these organizations came to Indonesia. I was there, and talked to many of them, and they were all plotting with plans on how to make Indonesia both democratic, liberal, and a free market society. Well, obviously now, going back, if those fellas who went to, came to Jakarta in 98, 99, revisited, they would see that a lot of the things that they had planned and designed according to particular kinds of assumptions having to do with their theoretical frameworks, their assumptions about development and so forth, actually do not pan out when we think about actual conflicts over power and resources and how unequal the terrain can be, and that in that unequal terrain, the forces of liberalism may be weak.
Thanks to Veri Hadiz, Mario Gomez, and Thinsa Shulayi for joining me today. If this is your first time joining us, then thanks for listening. The Oslo Governance Center is part of the United Nations Development Programme's Governance and Peacebuilding Cluster. You can follow the work of the OGC on UNDP's Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram pages, or on the Oslo Governance Center's website,